Living on the road, my friend, they're gonna keep you free and clean. Now you wear your skin like iron, your breath is hard as kerosene. You weren't your mama's only boy,
yeah,
but her favorite one, it seems. She began to cry when you said goodbye. Sank into your dreams. Pancho was a bandit boy. His horse was fast as polished steel. He wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. But Pancho met his match, you know,
on a desert
down in Mexico. Nobody heard his dying words.
Oh, but that's the way it goes.
Oh, but that's the way it goes. All the Federalists say could have had him any day. We only let him slip away. Out of kindness, I suppose. Bet he can't sing the blues all night long like he used to. The dust that Pancho bit down south ended up and left his mouth. The day they laid poor Pancho low, left he split for Ohio, where he got the bread to go. There ain't nobody.
We could have had him any day.
We only let him go so long.
Ha, ha, ha.
Out of kindness, I suppose.
Yeah, right. Them Federales are so kind. Bunker. Yeah, all day. This is Freya's day. This is She-Wolf day. And that goes out to She-Wolves because, you know, there were quite a number of famous female outlaws back in the old days. I can think of one real quick, but I'm sorry to say that she ran around with an Indian as a partner. She married, Belle Starr was her name. She was a product of the Civil War. But she ended up with a partner who was an Injun man. Anyhow, there were other female outlaws. Annie Oakley, of course, I don't believe was an outlaw, but she was a hell of a good shot. So anyhow, today's show goes out to the She-Wolves on Freya's Day. It is the 28th of August, and boy, I'll tell you, you only got two or three days left. You better get at it. You got a big master plan to save the white race, and you want to get it going. You only got about 3 days in August 2015 to do it. So get off your butt and activate it. Unless it's not time yet. And that's up to you. Yeah, lone wolves have their own schedules. Nobody makes a schedule for the lone wolf. The lone wolf acts when he's ready to act. In the meantime, he's just like a little fuzzy sheep. I'm still interested in what happened to Morris Sleaze Dees. He didn't even show up to that ceremony for Julian Bond. That's really odd, because everybody and their brother showed up for that big ceremony. So, I wonder what he's up to. He may be in the nut house by now. Who knows? I haven't even seen anything from Mark Potok lately. What the hell's he doing? Have they made so much money they're going to put the SPLC to bed? Or are they running out of bad guys to chase around? Yeah. Taped a little of a comedian last night. I'm going to run it here for you. Yeah, pretty funny. Pretty funny. Here we go. This is about the Constitution and the breakup of the country by a comedian, no less, I guess. Where's he at?
If you haven't read it, I hope you feel as stupid as I felt last year when I started this show and I hadn't read it yet. Four pages, that's the whole thing. That's our whole country based on four pages, which is pretty amazing, the Constitution. But the thing is, it worked. Well, it worked, and now this country's about to break up. People see this country as either, you know, the last best hope, hard work and fair play, or exploitation and greed, depending on, you know, whatever, however you like to see things. And like I said, we're going to break up. This country's going to get divorced. Red states, blue states, a house divided cannot stand. And you know who said that? Kris Jenner. That's correct. Trying to tell each other what to do. That's the whole thing. I want people to act this way. I want people to act that way. But the whole point of the Constitution is nobody gets to tell each other what to do. We don't get along. We don't agree on anything, but everybody loves the Constitution. I mean, soccer moms and strippers both talk about it. You know, cops and criminals, the Tea Party and the ACLU, everybody believes in the Constitution. Yeah, Declaration of Independence never really took off the way people thought it would. Even though that was important too, that was like our divorce papers from England. That was when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary. It's not you, England, it's us, but we have to go away. But the Constitution, everybody here knows it. We all know what it says. Nobody has to read it. You know, you can't, four pages, like I said, you have this kind of time, but, you know, everybody knows what it says because you can quote it when you... Friends get pulled over outside a bar. You have the friend that's a lawyer. Don't worry, they can't touch you if you're within 50 feet of a U.S. mailbox as a federal offense. That's the thing about the Constitution. It's the only document, the drunker you get, the better you understand what it says. And that's because it was written by the Founding Fathers. Our Constitution was written during a convention, which is a four-month bar crawl they had in Philadelphia in like 1787. Yeah. That's why our national character, our personality as a country, is kind of a bar personality. People look at us like the shining light on the beacon, like fun. They're having fun. The bar's open. We were a friendly country, a generous country. We'd be a little pushy sometimes, though. Not read the room, you know. Just like, try democracy. Give it a try. Like, I want to give it a sip, you know. It's like, it won't work over here. Trust me, it'll work in Iraq. Yeah, try it. No. We're a flirtatious country. We're like, come on over to our place after it closes. Everybody, you're tired, you're poor, you're huddled masses. Don't worry. Then wake up the next day, Jesus Christ, what are all these people doing in my house? I'm going to feed everybody. Like, who's out on my couch? I can't cook breakfast for everybody. We're the world's police. Whenever there's trouble, the whole world still comes to us. America, two tribes in the Middle East are about to go to war. We're like, oh, ho, break it up, guys. Seriously, truce. Here's $20. Buy them both a drink. No more fight, right? They're like, okay, the minute we walk away, they're like, every time we fight, they give us $20. I don't know. You want something? We were just borrowed. Only drunks do shit like this. You understand? We never know how much we have on us. Laura's like, hold on. I had trillions of dollars a couple of years ago. I know. A couple of wars. If you bail us, it can't be that broke, you know? We're the country everybody just look to because we're always happy, America. And now we're unhappy. Like I said, we're about to break up. It used to be Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Now we'll take a scene from Reservoir Dogs. And we're unhappy for a couple of reasons. One is we got to know each other because none of the states knew each other. We didn't know each other. Nobody knew Arizona and New York didn't know each other. You didn't ever see each other. But the internet got invented. And so they're like, oh my God, there's states like that? I didn't realize that. And the other thing was we went broke. And when you're broke, nothing's that cute anymore, you know. And why did we go broke? We went broke because we're trying to make everybody happy. That's the American dream. Everybody, no matter who you are, you just keep going. Rich, rich is rich. More rich than anybody. Middle class, rich is middle class. Make sure they call. Poor, even poor. Rich is poor people. Everybody gets a flat screen, gets a cell phone. Immigrants, everybody come on over. Come on over, everybody. Illegal. You come over too. Don't worry, we're not looking. Some people don't want to come over. Foreign aid. Send over money for the people who don't want to come over too. Trying to make everybody happy, and where is it written in our Constitution that we're supposed to go broke trying to make everybody happy? In the preamble. Actually, that's what the preamble says. The preamble says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, because perfect is fine for other countries, I respect that, more perfect is better for this country. And more perfect is very expensive, you know. Plastic surgery, more perfect, you know. Establish justice, laws, lawyers, lawsuits, you know, ensure domestic tranquility. You know how much money it costs to keep 300 million people tranquil every year? You need jobs, you need, you know, gadgets for everybody, food, antidepressants, tranquilizers. And provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Defense and welfare is 50% of the budget right there every year. That's the right and left right there, defense, welfare. Secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, because every generation is supposed to do better than the next, or somehow we failed. That was a sustainable idea somebody came up with. Do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America, you know. Now, if that's not a drunken, delusional promise, I don't know, you know. That's one of those things where the next day is supposed to wake up and go, listen, I said a lot of shit I didn't mean last night. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that's supposed to be. You know. But not these founding fathers, not these FFFs. They said, we can do it. They're so brilliant. Today, the country's gridlocked, and people still don't critique them. They still say they're brilliant. Even people that hate the founding fathers love the Constitution. The founding fathers, to this day, it's foolproof. They're like, hey, the country's gridlocked. It's not working. They're like, right, that's good. That means it's working. Not working. That's how it's not supposed to work. That's how it works. It's not working. Really, it's not supposed to not work this well because you did a pretty good job. Yeah. That's why this country got formed, because these guys knew they were brilliant. The geniuses knew they were geniuses. Everybody else, all the other colonies couldn't break away from England, never mind physically, psychologically, because they thought England was superior. These guys didn't think that. They came in like they're quoting Cicero, you know what I mean? Plato, they come in, you know, they're like, yeah. I talked to the governor of my colony. He doesn't even know who Montesquieu is. I mean, this guy's an idiot. You never heard of David Hume. Hey, did you read that John Locke piece and Poor Richard's Almanac? Yeah, it was pretty good. You know, they were like brilliant guys. You had 8 geniuses. Then you had 23 badass war veterans. So they had that natural cocky, you know, they're coming in all smoking. Like, yeah, I saw Bunker Hill. I heard about that. We had them kids, Bunker Hill. They didn't know what the fuck, you know, the Massachusetts contingent. Like, yeah, fucking kid. South Carolina's like, yeah, we took them down. They didn't know anything. They're coming in red coats. I mean, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. I swear to God. You know? They got the war stories. They're smoking. And then you had, like, James Madison. He was the whole guy that set it up. Because a lot of people weren't there, by the way. Adams, Jefferson, no accidents. I'm sure Madison's sick of hearing their names. He's just as much of a genius as them. So they happen to be out of the country when he decides to hold the convention. Basically, he's just sick of hearing. It's like George Harrison. You know, at a certain point, I'm sure he's like, you know, he's sick of hearing about Paul and John. Here comes the sun. That's The convention for him was Here Comes the Sun, the Bangladesh concert. And you got Madison, who's like the super nerd of all time. He puts the whole thing together. He knows he's got to get like a popular guy. Gets George Washington, because everybody loves George Washington. He's like the badass of the country. Everybody just wants to meet him. He brings him in. The whole country just loves George Washington for some reason. And then Ben Franklin, who was in Philly, he's like the godfather of the whole convention. Yeah, he gets up and gives a big opening speech. I'd like to welcome our friends from as far away as New Hampshire and good people of Georgia. How do we even let it get this far? I don't know.
Well, I forgot to write his name down. I think his name is Alan. He's on Netflix. If I see him again, I'll write his name down. But he got pretty well nailed on the history. There was quite a bit more in that gig, probably an hour's worth of entertainment. But he was right about one thing. This country is splitting up. And the guy that's helping us the most is Donald Trump. Trump is really doing a great job. If you look at it from our point of view, he's spreading separation. Yeah, he's spreading anxiety and anger and everything, which leads to separation. It's not important what he does as far as being elected, but all of this is causing the separatist idea to get more important all the time, because it's dividing, and that's one thing we need. Federal government wants us all come together. I want us to divide, man. Isn't that what we hear every day, 24 hours a day, diversity? Well, yeah, I want diversity. That means division. The other side is so stupid, they think diversity means integrating together, race mixing, miscegenation. How stupid can you be? I never realized how crazy these progressives were going to react to Trump. Every radio show on the internet is going absolutely bananas. I figured they'd sort of blow him off. But they're not blowing him off. They're giving him 100% exposure every day, every show. Oh, God, Hitler, Mussolini, he's a Stalin, he's a child molester. No, he's a, yeah, you know what I mean? He's the worst thing come down the pike just because he doesn't go along with politically correct speech. They hate it. They hate it. Let's get back to our pessimist guide to history. B.C. 164, deadly smallpox epidemic kills thousands. Soon after the Roman armies returned from the eastern Mediterranean, a smallpox epidemic broke out in Rome. You see how disease follows war and military and armies? Disease is created in warfare, and it spreads through the armies and so forth. The disease also spread throughout Europe and Persia, killing unknown thousands for over 10 years after the initial outbreak. Let's see, CA 88 SC, I guess, or BC, massacre of 100,000 Romans. They don't mess around. Mithridates VI, Eupator, ruler of the kingdom of Pontus, along the Black Sea, took advantage of the unrest in Rome to conquer Roman territories in Asia Minor and modern-day Syria. Deciding that the only way to control his newly won territories was to kill all the Romans living in them, he orchestrated the massacre of some 100,000 men, women, and children, an early example of genocide. Yeah, nothing new. Genocide's nothing new. In fact, war is genocide. Well, one more here. This is 87 to 80 B.C., more Romans die. You'd think they'd be running out of Romans pretty soon. Soon after the three-year social war that had drawn to a close, Rome found itself plunged into a series of bloody massacres as the Roman generals Lucius Cornelius Sulla and Gaius Marius fought for control of the city. This is about the time when the I know that the fellow that wrote White America, Xavier Cox, said no, that was Egypt. No, this is Rome. But this is when they had more non-whites get in the army in Rome. The trouble began when Sulla promised command of the campaign against the Mithridates in the east, discovered that the command had been transferred to the aged Marius. Instead, infuriated, Sulla marched on Rome with 35,000 men, drove Marius from the city, and took his men off to fight Mithridates. Marius took advantage of Sulla's absence to return to Rome with 6,000 soldiers and thousands of volatile slaves. Yeah, a lot of them were white, but more of them were black. He had freed from prison, you see here? So they use these slaves freed from prisons in the army. You see, that's where your problem starts. An orgy of violence erupted when Marius ordered the slaves to massacre Sulla's supporters. Blood ran in the streets during the five-day slaughter, and thousands of butchered bodies littered the city, Marius having refused to bury them. A year after Marius's death in 86 BC, Sulla and his army marched back into Rome, merciless in his reprisals against those who had sided with Marius. Sulla called for the immediate execution of thousands, including senators, businessmen, and prisoners. Hundreds of severed heads were prominently displayed around the town during the bloodbath, and Sulla's proscription list became longer each day. More than 4,700 Roman citizens were killed in Sulla's reign of terror, which finally ended with his retirement from dictatorship in 80 BC. This may be the only time in history that a dictator ever resigned of his own volition. In all fairness, Sulla did carry through a constitutional reform program to restore the supremacy of the Roman Senate. Maybe he just decided to quit while he was ahead. Yeah. There you go. That's the reading for today. Next, we'll cover the Roman gladiators' revolt in Rome. I'm going to read you something that was printed or authored back in 1997 by Major D.V. Clerken. I knew Clerken. I never met, I might have met him once, I'm not sure, but we talked on the telephone quite a bit. He wrote a lot of stuff, and he's dead now. He's been dead for at least 10 years, and so here we go. He calls this Afrocentric education. He was from Milwaukee. A lot of you old-timers might remembering. To teach men have wings and can fly sounds ridiculous to the average white person, but this sort of nonsense is what might be expected of a race of people that never developed a wheel, a sail, an inclined plane, a pulley, or a written language. Before you laugh it off, the Milwaukee schools have black immersion courses which teach just this mythology as fact. The ancient Egyptians, the story goes, were all black, and they could fly. They were equipped with wings. The pyramids were built by these flying black Egyptians. The huge blocks of stone lifted up and into place by teams of flying spooks. Then along came the Europeans from Greece, and seeing the elegant flying spooks became envious. Consequently, the white man shot the flying spooks down with arrows. On top of that, the evil white man proceeded to steal all the knowledge from the black Egyptians concerning the ability to erect a civilization, enslaving them in the process. Where was this knowledge stored? Why, of course, in the Library of Alexandria. Now, the Library of Alexandria was named after Alexander the Great, who lived from 356 BC to 323 BC. So the Library of Alexandria in northern Egypt had to be built after the death of Alexander the Great. After all, it was built in a city named after Alexander, and Alexandria could not have existed before 356 BC. And in fact, was established in 332 BC by Alexander the Great himself. Remember now that the Afrocentrics claim that the Greeks stole all the knowledge of Black Egypt from the Library of Alexandria, though the first Greek philosopher-scientist was Thales of Miletusan, Asia Minor, who died circa 546 B.C. There was an Anaximander of the Miletus school and Anaximenes, a younger associate of Anaximander. There was the school of Pythagoras, Heraclitus, an Ephesian, Parmenides, Zeno, and Empedocles, Anaxagora, and the Atomists. All these aforementioned white Aryan philosophers and scientists were known as cosmologists because their interest lay in the study of the cosmos, the earth, what is made of, and they lived and died centuries before the erection of the Library of Alexandria. The sophist, the pre-Socratic philosophers Socrates and Plato and Aristotle all lived and died before the founding of the Library of Alexandria. Here is what Frederick Copeland S.J. says in his history. And from the book History of Philosophy by Frederick Copeland, quote, the question may be raised whether or not Greek philosophy was due to Oriental influences, whether, for instance, it was borrowed from Babylon or Egypt, unquote. This view has been maintained but has had to be abandoned. The Greek philosophers and writers knew nothing of it. Even Herodotus, who was so eager to run his pet theory as to the Egyptian origins of Greek religion and civilization. And the Oriental origin theory is due mainly to the Alexandrian writers from whom it was taken over by Christian apologists, the Egyptians of Hellenistic times, the late classical age. For instance, in interpreting their myths according to the ideas of Greek philosophy, and then asserted that their myths were of origin of Greek philosophy. But this is simply an instance of allegorized on the part of the Alexandrians. It has no more objective value than the Jewish notion that Plato drew his wisdom from the Old Testament. That the Egyptians had a philosophy to communicate has never been shown. And it is out of the question to suppose that Greek philosophy came from India or China. So we have it on authority that not only was Greek science and philosophy not borrowed or stolen from the Egyptians, but not stolen from anyone else as well. The fact of history concerning ancient Egypt is that there were Egyptians and their slaves, a sub-Saharan Negro people whom the Romans identified as Nubians. The ancient Egyptians were a Hamitic people, sun bronze but not black. Egypt today is somewhat black because of the miscegenation over the centuries, especially since the rise of Islam, a faith which does not stress race. But it is certain that the people who designed and built the pyramids were not a black people. It may not have been people at all. That's Tommy's comment. Afrocentrics claim that Cleopatra was a black woman. Also Hannibal, who was Carthaginian, thus a descendant of the Semitic Phoenicians, is claimed by the Afrocentrics to have been black. Cleopatra was a Ptolemy, a descendant of the Macedonian general whom Alexander the Great left in charge of Egypt. As an Egyptian royal, the line of Cleopatra would not have been permitted to mix with Nubian slaves. Both Julius Caesar and Marcus Antonius had affairs with Cleopatra, Caesar giving her a son, Caesarion, and inviting her to come to Rome with their son, which angered the Roman Senate, fearing that Caesar, if made king, would have Cleopatra as his queen, and Antonius fought at her side against Octavian in Actium on 31 B.C. for control of the entire Roman world. Would either of these two foremost men of Rome have risked so much for a colored girl? As for Hannibal, well, there are extant busts of his Carthaginian general sculpted by the Romans at the time of his threat to the Roman state. You remember we talked about this yesterday. Certainly Hannibal was no black man. The Egyptians from the Old Kingdom and the building of the pyramids to the time of Cleopatra were definitely not Negro people. No Negroid people anywhere in the world has ever accomplished anything beyond bare racial survival. And in Africa, there is nothing below the Sahara Desert denoting any sort of civilization until the coming of either Arabs or the Europeans later. Yet the Afrocentrics teach black children that once upon a time they could fly. We Aryan racialists, as mean as we are supposed to be, would not ever teach anyone fairy tales as facts. A few months ago, I talked over the phone with a high school class in Ohio. During the symposium, a young girl of mixed race challenged me to prove that the prominent men of ancient world were not all black. I said that we have statues and busts of Caesar, Augustus, Cicero, Cato, Demosthenes, Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates. We know what they look like. Her response to this was, "Oh, those statues are probably fake." "Why?" I asked her. "Because the racists of those times did not want the black people to know their greatness." "Who told you these things?" I responded. "My church teaches us history lessons in Sunday school. The black race is still childlike. It will believe whatever promotes itself, no matter how illogical." My purpose in doing this article is twofold. One, to teach a history lesson to young Aryans who have never been taught the history of the world. And two, to warn young Aryans that mixing with these childlike blacks is a path towards the destruction of the white race and all it has conceived, all it will ever accomplish. Even the best of blacks are not fit to consort with, for they can only be what they are and have been, a backward race without a history of their own, forced to steal the history of the white man and proclaim such idiocies as their birthright. I would imagine that these same black crackheads come to believe in their stupors that indeed they do have wings and can fly. Thank you, Donald Clerkin, and that was from his periodical called, he used to call it the Talon, T-A-L-O-N. That was from 1997. He also called his little group the Euro-American Alliance out of Milwaukee. Too bad he's dead. He was really a good guy and a teacher. My friend Revelo, Professor Revelo P. Oliver, who's been dead for a long time, was brilliant, the most brilliant man in the Aryan struggle. And it's amazing today how few people know about him. The new young guys don't get any word about him. None of these right-wing organizations, racial organizations, talk about Revelo P. Oliver. However, he was the wisest, most intelligent man that's ever been involved in the white struggle. Now, we, through Wolf Wall Street, we took all these magazines. I had a hundred or so of the Liberty Bell magazines and put them PDF for up on our website. Now, you can go up there and find them. Tremendous articles by Revelo P. Oliver and a lot of other people, including Major Clerkin that I just read you. And so people should be studying those because they're the most advanced and intelligent, wise pieces of information you can get on the subject of race. But I'd like for you to go on to the website for these right-wing racial groups and say, who is Revelo P. Oliver? And most people don't have any idea who he was. Anyhow, he's talking about niggers here. Niggers are aliens in a white nation, no matter where they were born. Nigger is a useful, almost indispensable word. It is simply Niger, N-I-G-E-R, with the consonant doubled to keep the vowels short. It is simply Niger, like I said, with the consonant double to keep the vowel short and the consonant hard, but in American usage, it includes not only pure-blooded Congoids, but also mulattoes and Sambos. It would be incorrect to call a mulatto, for example, the offspring of an Aryan whore and a male Congoid. A Congoid, as it would be to call a creature Aryan. Much the same objection applies to Negro, used as a racial term. It was standard term for Congoid slaves in Spanish, which was the international language of commerce and so used by the predominantly Jewish merchants who brought the livestock to the United States. In the antebellum South, Negro man or Negro woman was so understood, and it would have been a tautology to add the information that a slave was meant. In British usage, nigger also includes Dravidians and other dark-skinned people. In Britain, incidentally, black man would be highly misleading since the British usage of the term designated a white man with black hair, conspicuously uncommon in Nordic countries, and usually the dark eyes and somewhat swarthy complexion that go with such hair. The resulting ambiguity is much exploited by the bunkum artists who concoct black history for the suckers in the universities that have become intellectual whorehouses. So there you go. That was Revlo P. Oliver's comments on nigger. I apologize for any interruptions in the show today. I've got my close neighbor is having a garage sale, and there's cars coming in all over the place, and my dogs go crazy. So if I have to cut and come back on once in a while, that's the reason. Now, this was written in 1991 called Whose Superiority? As the year 1991 drew to its close, the mayor of Dubuque, Iowa, was unhappy. Dubuque is a small city, about 63,000, on the west bank of the Mississippi River, facing the border between Wisconsin and Illinois. But it is a provincial, stodgy, unprogressive, backward, even reactionary. During the entire year, not a single one of the white boobs who elected the mayor had been killed by a nigger. No white woman had been raped to teach her about civil rights. So far as was known, all the white females were so full of prejudice and bigotry that none had recognized their duty to copulate with niggers and breed diseased mongrels to further the American ideal of integration. And there hadn't even been a good mugging. What was worse, white boobs actually went out on the streets at night, sometimes alone and returning safely to their homes without being taught the place they had made for themselves in the world. In progressive communities such as Jerusalem on the Hudson and Tel Aviv on the Potomac, there is a murder every few hours. It is true that, regrettably, often niggers kill other niggers. But intensive education financed by the taxpayers can lead them to make better use of their homicidal urges. In the District of Corruption, the civil rights workers have become so zealous that they extend their good work as far as Fairfax County in Virginia, where they trap and rape white women at the rate of 95 per annum, and will doubtless do better in the future. The mayor of Dubuque knew the reason for the deplorable situation in that city. The population of the little city is almost entirely Aryan and largely Germanic. There is a contingent of the ubiquitous Sheenies, of course, but only about 1,000 other aliens, only a third of them, are niggers. To the sapient mayor, the way to bring progress to Dubuque was obvious: import niggers. And the proposal was well-timed, almost coinciding with the planned invasion of Florida from Haiti, which Bushy's government for some reason called off at the last moment. A few thousand refugees from Haiti would not only have remedied the city's backwardness, but with the help of the white witch doctors in the churches and the schools, have raised the cultural level. They would have taught the stolen Aryans how to twist off the head of a white chicken and drink the blood that spurts from the severed neck. Practitioners of voodoo could have spread wisdom from the pulpits of the churches eager to practice ecumenism, And who knows, Dubuque might have attained honorable mention in the Chicago Tribune for the pious sacrifice of a hornless goat, preferably white. The mayor, and it seems quite a few idiots in Dubuque, were horrified when some Aryan racist professed a belief in white superiority, a damnable doctrine that clearly contravenes the American resolve to become the most degraded and despised species of talking anthropoids. But black superiority? Ah, that would have been another matter with the doctrine. Dubuque could ride the wave of the future. Oh, that's the kind of wit the professor had, Revlo P. Oliver. Incidentally, his name, Revlo P. Oliver, spells same way forward and backward. Interesting. I want to get an idea how smart he was. He's the one who transferred Sanskrit into English. Evidently, as far as I know, the first person who had done that. And here's a little bit more. Every observer knows, of course, that niggers justly despise a race so stupid that lets them vote, elects them to political office, taxes itself to provide them with comforts, and taxes itself some more to accelerate their breeding. Few, however, realize that this natural contempt has given rise to formal doctrines of black superiority. The first such doctrine seriously formulated in the United States was the work of the black Muslims, a movement founded in Detroit by an itinerant mulatto whose name is thought to have been Wallace Fard, but who used at least six aliases in Detroit, including Professor Ford, Farad Muhammad Ali, and Supreme Ruler of the Universe. When the Ruler of the Universe was convicted of some crime, white bigots in Detroit sent him to jail for a year, and when released, he disappeared. It was rumored that while he was in the Hoosgow, one of his followers had an inspiration to take over the lucrative business for himself, and accordingly, when the Supreme Ruler got out of jail, used him as a hornless goat in a ritual that the ruler had himself devised. The exponential growth of the black Muslims was the work of a talented mulatto named Elijah Poole, who gave himself half a dozen new names before 1930. When he settled on Elijah Muhammad, messenger of Allah and divine leader and of the lost found nation of Islam, and took over the cult. He moved his holy household, including his 20 servants and his assortment of Cadillacs, from Detroit to Chicago and began to train tough young niggers in paramilitary tactics. Since he aped a few Muhammadan rites, he enabled the statisticians to determine that Islam was the fastest growing religion in the United States. How much of the cult's historical and ethnology views the messenger of Allah invented is uncertain. Well, anyhow, there's a whole thing about the official doctrine of this cosmos. Oh, man, this is something else. When, in accordance with the will of Allah, the earth was separated from the moon by an explosion in the year 65 and followed by about 9 sets of zeros, there appeared on the planet the black race, as black and perfect as God himself. For almost 66 trillion years, these perfect beings dwelt in perfect happiness, speaking Arabic, an event evidently leading the joyous and unfettered life now to be found in the jungles of the Congo. The universal bliss was troubled, however, in 4707 BC when a black scientist named Yaqub determined to create artificially a race of debased and inferior creatures. He worked steadily for 600 years, and finally, by grafting and rigid birth control, he produced the blue-eyed devils, white men who are physically weak and totally evil. Allah, for purposes of his own and intending the ultimate exaltation of his chosen people, who are the only true human beings, permitted the white devils to interfere with nature and set up the nasty thing called civilization. He even permitted the vile spooks to dominate and enslave. Let's see. Where am I at here? I guess that was the end of that quote. Anyhow, he goes on to say, now that was what their doctrine was. Now, this is what Oliver says, I believe. I chiefly rely on the work of two educated mulattoes who penetrated the Lost Found Nation and reported their observations. Professor C. Eric Lincoln, The Black Muslims in America, and Professor E. U. Isin Odom, Black Nationalism, The Voodoo Cult in Detroit, in the American Journal of Sociology for 1937-38. I do not know how much of the official doctrine was already contained in the supreme ruler of the universe's material for niggers, which was entitled Teaching for the Lost Foundation of Islam in a Mathematical Way. Seven down here, footnote, spook is nigger slang for white man. I didn't know that. Often used in the presence of members of our hated race to prevent them from guessing that they are the subject of conversation or in writing when it is desired to be discreet. Thus, in the printed catalog of the University of Islam, in which the cosmology outlined above is taught to advanced students, those who have passed the courses in reading and writing, that is, the course in world history is entitled Spook Being Displayed for 6,000 Years. I refer to the catalog of this institution of higher learning in 1961. Whether the nigger zone Harvard is still operating, I don't know. Oh boy, this is good stuff. I love it. Nobody can write like Revlo P. Oliver. Another little footnote. Something about the chosen people by devising a devil doctrine called Christianity. I'm not sure how that hooked up there. He decreed, however, that the white swine were to rule the world for exactly 6,000 years. Their time was up in 1914. They may be right about that, because that's when we started major fratricide warfare. But they are now enjoying a few years of grace until the black man can rise and exterminate them from the face of the earth and come into his own again. Of this there can be no doubt, no possible doubt whatever, because all history has been written in advance by 24 black scientists, unquote. Yeah, baby. Now, as we go into this campaign season, there's something that Charlie Reese wrote years ago. I was interviewed once by Charlie Reese. He was one of the older, well, he wasn't old at the time, but he was one of the conservatives of the time before we had neocons. And Charlie wrote this article, Here's How to Control People. It's something you should know right during this campaign season. The difference between true education and vocational training has been cleverly blurred. Here are a few tips on how very smart people can control other people. If any of this rings a bell, well then, wake up. The first principle of people control is not to let them know you're controlling them. If people know this, knowledge will breed resentment and possibly rebellion, and which could then require brute force and terror, an old-fashioned, expensive, and not 100% certain method of control. It is easier than you think to control people indirectly, to manipulate them into thinking what you want them to think and doing what you want them to do. One basic technique is to keep them ignorant. Educated people are not as easy to manipulate. Abolishing public education or restricting access to education would be a direct approach. That would spill the beans. The indirect approach is to control education they do receive. It's possible in our time to be a PhD, a doctor, a lawyer, a businessman, a journalist, and an accountant, just to name a few examples, and at the same time be an uneducated person. The difference between true education and vocational training has been cleverly blurred in our time, so that we have people successfully practicing their vocations while at the same time being totally ignorant of the larger issues of the world in which they live. These are called, I call them, well, I didn't invent this, ignorant, intelligent people. The most obvious symptom is their absence of original thought. Ask them a question, they will end up reciting what someone else thinks or thought the answer or is or was. What do they think? Well, they never thought about it. Their education consists of learning how to use the library and cite sources. That greatly simplifies things for the controller, because with lots of money, university endowments, foundations, grants, and the ownership of media, it's relatively easy to control who they will think of as authorities to cite in lieu of doing their own thinking. The internet's full of that now. You think you're getting all the good information on the internet? No, you're just getting more bad information. Another technique is to keep them entertained. The Roman emperors did not stage circuses and gladiator contests because they didn't have television. We have television because we don't have circuses and gladiator contests. Either way, the purpose is to keep the people's minds focused on entertainment, sports, peripheral political issues. Well, politics has turned into just plain entertainment now. That way you won't have to worry that they will ever figure out the real issues that allow you to control them. Just as a truly educated person is difficult to control, so too is an economically independent person. Therefore, you want to create conditions that will produce people who work for wages, since wage earners have little control over their economic destiny. You'll also want to control the monetary, credit, and banking system. This will allow you to inflate the currency and make it next to impossible for wage earners to accumulate capital. You can also cause periodic deflations to collapse the small businesses, family farms, and entrepreneurs, including independent community banks. To keep trade unions under control, you just promote a scheme that allows you to shift production jobs out of the country and bring back the products as imports. It's called free trade. This way you'll end up with no unions or docile unions, which has happened today. Another technique is to buy both political parties so that after a while people will feel no matter whether they vote for candidate A or candidate B, they will get the same policies. This will create great apathy and belief that the political process is useless for effecting change. That's exactly what it is. That's what we keep saying. Pretty soon you will have a population that feels completely helpless and thinks the bad things beginning to them are nobody in particular's fault, just a result of global sources or evolution or some other disembodied abstract concept. If necessary, you can offer scapegoats. Then you can bleed them dry without having to worry overly much that one of them will sneak into your house one night and cut your throat. If you do it right, they won't even know whose throat deserves cutting. So there you go. Very smart. Wise. Well, that's about it for Freya's Day. I hope all the she-wolves out there have a great day, a great evening. Get out there and maybe dance a little, sing a little, have a little fun, go to a movie, do something, relax. Now, I'll be back on Moon's Day. In the meantime, I'll be doing honey-do projects. I'll have to pick up my gal at the airport. She's coming back from her vacation. And so I'll have somebody here to wash the dishes for a change. They're getting pretty stacked up. Just kidding. I have no problem doing housework. When I was a kid and my mom and dad were working from dawn till dusk, old Tommy did the floors, he did the dishes, he did all kinds of stuff. So I'm not embarrassed to do women's work. Incidentally, it's not women's work, it's the whole family's work. Okay, see you Monday. 14:05, and I have nothing to say. Remember that. Don't forget it.
Ball and chain, they call me by a number, not a name, Lord, Lord. Gotta do my time, gotta do my time. taken home and a worried mind. That old judge looked down and smiled. Said, I'll put you on that good road for a while, Lord. Gotta do my time. Gotta do my time with an aching heart and a worried mind. You can hear my hammer. You can hear my song. I'm going to swing it like John Henry all day long. Oh, Lord. Gotta do my time. Gotta do my time with an aching heart and a worried mind. Settle down and put my body bears on the door. With that gal of mine, with that gal of mine, she'll be waiting for me when I've done my time.
Oh man, I'm getting off of this rock pile right now, and I'll see you Monday.